Last year I gave a sermon entitled The Arrest, Trial and Death of Jesus. Now, at that time we looked very carefully at Matthew 26 and 27, at what was a very tumultuous time. But this time, what I want to do, and I've spent quite a lot of time putting this together, is look at all of the illegalities surrounding Christ's crucifixion. So the title is The Illegal Crucifixion. And in the sermon today, I want to quote from a number of sources. I want to quote from the booklet by Mr. James McRuer, former Chief Justice of the High Court of Justice in Ontario, Canada, and former President of the Canadian Bar Association. Now, I did quote from his book last year. I would mention that he does hold with the Good Friday and Easter Sunday tradition, but what I'm doing today is quoting his analysis and research on the illegality of Christ's crucifixion, which is extensive and very helpful. I've also looked at other authors, the old correspondence course, which listed 12 reasons why Jesus' trial was illegal. I've looked at Mr. Link's book, Jesus Christ, A Great Mystery. I've looked at the historian Josephus, Bible commentaries and other sources, and of course, most importantly, the Bible, because everything has got to be from the Bible, where all the other information must agree with what Scripture says. Now, it's taken a lot of research. I hope you'll feel that it's worthwhile. And as I say, if you want a copy of these notes afterwards, I'm quite happy to email them to you. But let me set the scene. If you'll turn to Matthew 5, verse 20, here are some comments made in the chapter that contains the Beatitudes. And Jesus then goes on to say the following in Matthew 5, verse 20. Matthew 5 verse 20 says, "For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven." And Mr. McRuer gives the reason why the religious authorities were a bit miffed with Jesus. He states the following. He says, "In the synagogues of Galilee, Jesus' voice was heard as one with a mission. Is were strong words, revolutionary words, that preach rebellion, not against the power of Rome, but against special privilege in everything religious. He was a humble man, a carpenter's son, but I would add that he was, of course, a stepson. To the crowds that came to hear him, he taught as a man of astonishing knowledge and one who had authority, not as their scribes. Such teaching could not be long disregarded by the religious rulers. It can be hardly mere coincidence that from these early days of his career, the local scribes, Pharisees, and Sadducees in Galilee were quick to seek anything in Jesus' teaching or behavior that could be interpreted as unlawful. They were equally quick to lay snares for him in order to secure admissions that might support evidence of a capital crime. Apart from the scribes, there were four main religious sects or parties among the Jews, all of which looked forward to the coming of the Messiah in deliverance out of bondage. And they were the Zealots, the Pharisees, the scribes, and the Essenes. Now, Josephus, who himself was a Pharisee, says of them, of his own group, he says, "A cunning sect they were, and soon elevated to a pitch of open fighting and doing mischief." So he got his own group weighed up pretty carefully there. At the time of Christ, the Pharisaical fraternity was comparatively small. It numbered 6,000 members, but it was nevertheless influential. Contact with non-Pharisees was avoided whenever possible. All others were unclean. And I can tell you a story about that. When my wife and I were in Jerusalem in, I think, about 1980, and I was in the post office at Jerusalem getting some stamps to put on postcards. That was in the days before people were texting and emailing and Facebooking and whatever that they do these days. So while I was trying to get these postage stamped, my wife was at the back and she got a short sleeve sweater or jumper on. And there was a Jewish gentleman there who was standing and he wouldn't go past her. And what had to happen is one of the locals had to stand in front of my wife so he could pass. And the reason was that she got a short sleeve jumper or sweater on, which was incredible. So Pharisaical, unbelievable. And of course they were part of the Meashirim, which are a Polish group, Polish descent. They have these unclipped side locks. They have the kaftan on. They live in an area where they only speak Yiddish. And if you drive your car in their area on the Sabbath, you will be stoned. I mean, they are that right wing. But anyway, that's an aside. Back to the main message. Annas, the high priest, was a Sadducee, and the Pharisees were in open conflict with the Sadducees, with whom they struggled for both civil and ecclesiastical power. Free will, predestination, and the resurrection of the body were all areas of dogmatic differences. Mr. McRuer states that whatever may have been the theological and philosophical differences between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, Jesus' early ministry arrested the attention of the leaders of both parties. So here they were, seeing a threat to them. They saw in his teaching new concepts of human values and human obligations. Concepts that, if allowed to take root and to grow, would destroy not only much of the power they wielded in their religious offices, but many of the vested interests which were the source of their great wealth. From the early days, they were united in one thing: the determination that Jesus' ministry would be of short duration. It just shows what lengths some will go in order to protect their own interests and the power that they long for and they covet. And of course we see that today with politicians. In such circumstances, the very worst traits of men rise to the surface. Annas, high priest and a Sadducee, and his confederates were doing a thriving trade, not only in objects of sacrifice, doves, goats and lambs, but exchange as well. Everyone who had attained the age of 21 years was required to pay annually a half shekel into the sacred treasury. The half shekel was the only one that was acceptable as an offering to God. The money changers of the temple provided the necessary half shekel, a service gladly rendered at profit. They did a roaring trade. If you'll turn to Matthew 21, verses 12 and 13, we read where, as the subheading says, Jesus cleanses the temple. And Jesus knew all about the money making that went off in a supposedly holy place. Matthew 21, verse 12. Then Jesus went into the temple of God and drove out all those who bought and sold in the temple and overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold doves. And he said to them, "It is written, my house shall be called a house of prayer, but you have made it a den of thieves." The New Bible commentary states that the court of the Gentiles provided a market for the sale of temple requisites and an exchange to provide Jewish coinage. Mr. McRuer, in his booklet, shows how those at odds with one another can come together when faced with what they perceive is a common enemy. He writes, "Ecclesiastically and theologically, the Pharisees were in wide disagreement. But on one thing they agreed. Jesus had exposed to view the corrupt practices of their ecclesiastical leaders. They both had a burning desire to guard with vigilance all their vested interests they enjoyed in the fruits of devotion to every letter of the law." Now, over a few pages, if you will, pages Matthew 26, verses 1 to 5, we see the plot to kill Jesus. Someone who had done nothing but good, helping and healing people and teaching them the right ways of God. And here we read in Matthew 26 verse 1 when it says, "Now it came to pass when Jesus had finished all these sayings that he said to his disciples, 'You know that after 2 days is the Passover, and the Son of Man will be delivered up to be crucified.' Then the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders of the people assembled at the palace of the high priest, who was called Caiaphas, and plotted to take Jesus by trickery and kill him. But they said, 'Not during the feast, lest there be an uproar among the people.'" These religious men were bloodthirsty. Nothing less than Jesus' death would accomplish their task of ensuring that their power, prestige, and money-making exercises would continue. Mr. McRuer continues, "Annas was the one who was now in a dilemma. Peter's assault on the slave," and we can read that, I'm not going to turn to it, in John 18 verse 10, "had publicly connected the high priest with the seizure of Jesus. Annas knew too well all the administrative technicality of the Hebraic criminal law. He must have known that secret assassination was now out of the question. It was better that the destruction of Jesus be given a cloak of respectability. Some form of judicial procedure was to be the cloak, no matter how stained with stained and saturated with illegality. The Sanhedrin was called in an emergency session to sit during the night. For the Sanhedrin evidence there must be, but Annas took to himself the task of securing that evidence where others had failed. He questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. All Annas' questions were answered with quiet dignity. Now the Sanhedrin exercised the final authority in all matters, religious, social, political, legislative, and judicial, and was comprised of 70 members with the high priest at its head. The native Hebrew term translated was the High Council of the High Court, and the Sadducean influence predominated. In all criminal cases, the Hebrew law was strict, and it was much that way in capital cases. The death penalty was prescribed from a whole catalogue of offences, from being a stubborn and rebellious son to murder. These offences also included blasphemy, profaning the Sabbath after warning, sorcery, idolatry, and being a false prophet. 4 types of execution were prescribed according to the character of the offence: stoning, burning, strangling, and beheading, none of which to me sounds very inviting. These were said to be in descending order according to the gravity of the offence. If an accused was found to be liable to 2 death penalties, the law prescribed that he be punished by the more severe. Crucifixion was not a penalty authorized by the Hebrew law. It was a Roman form of punishment. Now, one source I found on the internet stated this about crucifixion. He said, "Crucifixion is arguably the most painful and horrible form of torture and death that can be inflicted on man. The Romans chose this form of execution as it was a deterrent to insurrection and disobedience. Crucifixion was designed to kill by suffocation. That is the reason the feet were either nailed, blocked up, or the victim was fitted with a saddle or peg placed under the groin so that the victim could breathe. Often the condemned would suffer on the cross for days. Crucifixion was considered to be so extreme a punishment that Roman citizens were generally exempt from that form of punishment. Jesus was not the only man to be crucified. Hundreds of thousands of Jews and other citizens in the conquered nations of the Roman Empire were crucified as the Romans carried out their imperial expansion. They used crucifixion to bring order to their rule. And so that is some of the backdrop that accompanied the events leading to Christ's death. And it's pretty scary stuff. So now let us look at those legalities with which the religious establishment of the day completely ignored. He was convicted and executed even though Pilate found him innocent. So the first one, for those making notes, is there was no basis for Jesus' arrest because no one had presented a formal charge of any crime. There was no legal basis for Jesus' arrest because no one had presented a formal charge of any crime. If you'll turn to Luke 22, verse 52, where we read that those who went with Judas to have Jesus arrested actually included the priests and elders, among whom were those, the ones who bribed Judas. Luke 22, verse 52. Then Jesus said to the chief priests, captains of the temple, and the elders who had come to him, "Have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs?" He was simply taken as a common criminal without any charge. And Mr. Link wrote in his book, Jesus Christ, A Great Mystery, he wrote the following. He said, "No charge was brought against Christ when he was arrested. No charge had been made yet. He was arrested in order to prevent a potential tumult. They came by night. Jesus himself said that they came as against a robber, as if they had to arrest him right away." Matthew 26, verse 55 continues, "In that hour Jesus said to the multitudes, 'Have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs to take me? I sat daily with you, teaching in the temple, and you did not seize me.'" Christ was saying that there was really no need to arrest him in such a way, in today's terminology, without a warrant. Christ had not done anything to justify this kind of procedure. But Christ knew, of course, that Satan was behind all of this. "Let us emphasize again," said Mr. Link, "that Christ was not arrested based on any formal charge of any crime that he had allegedly committed. There was no legal basis for the arrest. Nobody had presented evidence or even testified before the Sanhedrin to justify or warrant an arrest." So, to repeat it, there was no legal basis for Jesus' arrest because no one had presented a formal warrant at that time. So, illegal act number two was that Jewish law only permitted daylight proceedings. Jewish law permitted only daylight proceedings. Let's look at John 18. Verses 12 to 14, and let us remember that Jesus was subject to a secret preliminary examination at night, but Jewish law only permitted daylight proceedings. John 18, verse 12 says, "Then the detachment of troops and the captain and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him. And they led him away to Annas first, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest that year. Now it was Caiaphas who advised the Jews that it was expedient that one man should die for the people." And dropping down to verses 19 to 24. "The high priest then asked Jesus about his disciples and his doctrine. Jesus answered him, 'I spoke openly to the world. I always taught in synagogues and in the temple where the Jews always meet. And in secret I've said nothing. Why do you ask me? Ask those who heard me what I said to them. Indeed they know what I said.' And when he had said these things, one of the officers who stood by struck Jesus with the palm of his hand, saying, 'Do you answer the high priest like that?' Jesus answered him, 'If I have spoken evil, bear witness of the evil, but if well, why do you strike me? Then Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas the high priest. And again, Mr. Link makes these observations in his booklet. He says, Christ's interrogation before Annas was illegal. First of all, they brought him to Annas by night, but the Jewish law prohibited all proceedings by night. No session of the court could take place before the offering of the morning sacrifice. The Sanhedrin only sat in session from the close of the morning sacrifice until the time of the evening sacrifice. That is, they would only sit in session during the day. They would never sit in session during the night. And if you'll turn to Acts 4, verses 1 to 3, this actually confirms the fact. Acts 4, verse 1. This is where Peter and John were arrested. They weren't tried during the evening or night, but were held in custody until the following day. So Acts 4, verse 1. Now as they spoke to the people, the priest, the captain of the temple, and the Sadducees came upon them, being greatly disturbed that they taught the people and preached in Jesus the resurrection from the dead. And they laid hands on them and put them in custody until the next day, for it was already evening. They knew that if they wanted to abide by their own law, they couldn't do anything during the night. Verse 5 continues, And it came to pass on the next day that their rulers, elders and scribes, as well as Annas the high priest, Caiaphas, John and Alexander, and as many as were of the family of the high priest, were gathered together at Jerusalem. They got together the next day to start the trial against the apostles. They didn't do it during the night. And so only daylight proceedings were allowed. So let's move on to illegality number three. The indictment against Jesus was illegal because the judges themselves brought up the charge. The indictment against Jesus was illegal because the judges themselves brought up the charge without any prior testimony from any witnesses. The Jewish court, the Sanhedrin, was not allowed to originate charges. It was just not allowed by their law. In the book Life and Times of Jesus the Messiah, Alfred Edersheim states that the Sanhedrin did not and could not originate charges. Mr. Link mentions this same matter on page 47 of his booklet. He says, In addition, when Christ was brought before the high priest, Caiaphas, and the Sanhedrin, no charge had been made against him. This is important because under Jewish law, the Sanhedrin could not originate charges. If somebody was brought before the Sanhedrin there was no charge made against them, they had to let them go. The Sanhedrin violated their own law, as they were not interested in letting Christ go. They tried to originate charges during the trial. They attempted to do so by producing witnesses. And so illegality number three is the indictment against Jesus was illegal because the judges themselves brought up the charge without any prior testimony from any so-called witnesses. Illegality number four. The court illegally proceeded to hold its trial of Jesus before sunrise so that no one would be available to testify on his behalf. I'll read that again. The court illegally proceeded to hold its trial of Jesus before sunset so that no one would be available to testify on Jesus' behalf. If you turn to Matthew 26, verses 55 to 56, let us read what it says here, and you will see why there would be no witnesses. Matthew 26, verse 55. It says, Matthew 26, verse 55, In that hour, Jesus said to the multitudes, "Have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs to take me? I sat daily with you teaching in the temple, and you did not seize me. But all this was done that the scriptures of the prophets might be fulfilled." Then all the disciples forsook him and fled. So anybody that could be a witness for him had gone. They'd fled. How could Jesus' disciples testify on his behalf after they'd gone? And in verses 69 to 75 of this same chapter, as we know, Peter denied Jesus. Mendelssohn, in Criminal Jurisprudence of Ancient Hebrews, reveals why it was illegal. He says, "Criminal cases can be acted upon by the various courts during the daytime only, and by the lesser Sanhedrins from the close of the morning sacrifice till noon, and by the great Sanhedrin till evening." The Jewish Mishnah states, "Let a capital offence be tried during the day, but suspend at night." The Mishnah is the oldest authoritative post-biblical collection and codification of Jewish oral laws, systematically compiled by numerous scholars over a period of about two centuries. Moses Maimonides, who was a preeminent medieval Jewish philosopher and one of the most prolific, and who followed Torah scholars and physicians of the Middle Ages, explains why trials were to be held during the daylight. He said, "The reason why the trial of a capital offence could not be held at night is because the examination of such a charge is like the diagnosing of a wound. In either case, a more thorough and searching examination can be made by daylight." So that's illegality number four. The court proceeded to hold its trial of Jesus before sunrise so that Jesus wouldn't have any witnesses. Number five, Jewish law did not permit the trial of a capital offence to begin on a day before a weekly Sabbath or a holy day. Jewish law did not permit the trial of a capital offence to begin on a day before a weekly Sabbath or a holy day. Jesus was arrested and tried the day before a Sabbath. That also happened to be the first day of unleavened bread. If you'll turn to John 18, verse 28. John 18, verse 28. This was after Jesus had been illegally questioned by the high priest and Peter had denied Jesus. John 18, verse 28. It says, "Then they led Jesus from Caiaphas to the praetorium, and it was early morning. But they themselves did not go into the praetorium, lest they should be defiled, but that they might eat the Passover." And in the next chapter, John 19, verse 31, John 19, verse 31, we read that the Sabbath was a holy day, a high day. The first day of unleavened bread. It says, John 19, verse 31, "Therefore, because it was the preparation day, that the bodies should not remain on the cross of the Sabbath, for that Sabbath was a high day." And a high day was an annual holy day. "The Jews asked Pilate that their legs might be broken, and that they might be taken away." In the Mishnah, it states the following, "They shall not judge on the eve of the Sabbath, nor of that on any festival." And Rabbi Wise, in his book Martyrdom of Jesus, wrote the following. He said, "No court of justice in Israel was permitted to hold sessions on the Sabbath or any of the seven biblical holy days. In cases of capital crime, no trial could be commenced on Friday or the day previous to any holy day, because it was not lawful either to adjourn such cases longer than overnight or to continue them on the Sabbath or holy day." So that was yet another illegality. Under number six, Jesus' trial was concluded in one day, but the law in the Mishnah says that this cannot be done. Jesus' trial was concluded in one day. A criminal case resulting in the acquittal of the accused may terminate the same day on which the trial began. But if a sentence of death is to be pronounced, it cannot be concluded before the following day. And that's from the Mishnah again, which is their rules and regulations. This was done to allow sufficient opportunity for any witnesses in support of the accused to present themselves. Forcing the trial to last longer than one day allows time for witnesses in support of the accused to come forth. Of course, Jesus' court did not want any such witnesses to manifest themselves, so they ended it quickly. Jesus' trial was conducted in private and completed in less than 9 hours. Again, quoting from Mr. McRuer in his book, he says, even the disciples, not Christ's disciples, but the students and the sages who attended the court, were permitted to argue in favour of acquittal, but not for conviction. In such case, the disciple was brought up to sit among the members of the court and remained with them throughout the day. When there was a conviction, sentence could not be passed on the same day. The members of the court were required to go in pairs, eating very little and drinking no wine, to discuss the matter all night and come together the following morning. On the following morning, commencing with the most junior member of the court, lest he be influenced by his seniors, each was required to make his declaration. Those in favour of acquittal would say, I declared him innocent yesterday, and I still declare him innocent. And those in favour of conviction would say, I declared him guilty yesterday, and I still declare him guilty. He who favoured conviction might afterwards acquit, but he who favoured acquittal might not retract and favour conviction. It's interesting that these safeguards in respect of any sentencing were always in favour of the accused, so that errors of judgment were minimised or eliminated. So, Jesus' trial was concluded in one day, which the law did not allow. On to number 7. Number 7 is, two false witnesses charged Jesus with saying he would destroy the temple made with hands. Let us look at Mark 14, verses 55 to 59. This is where Jesus had been taken to the high priest, and they were all seeking testimony against someone who had done nothing but good. Of course, he had ruffled their feathers, but they obviously needed ruffling. So Mark 14, verse 55, we'll start reading there. It says, now the chief priests and all the council sought testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but found none. For many bore false witness against him, but their testimonies did not agree. Then some rose up and bore false witness against him, saying, we heard him say, I will destroy this temple made with hands, and within 3 days I will build another made without hands. But even then, their testimony did not agree. Now, if you just go back, if you will, please, to Deuteronomy 17, verse 6. Let's have a quick look here, where this question as to the number of witnesses needed for a capital crime is clearly shown. Deuteronomy 17, verse 6. And of course, if this was implemented in the USA and the UK today, there'd be far fewer convictions where people are convicted on circumstantial evidence and other things, not on witnesses. Deuteronomy 17, verse 6 says, whoever is deserving of death shall be put to death on the testimony of 2 to 3 witnesses. he shall not be put to death on the testimony of one witness. So one witness wasn't good enough. They needed two or three. And Mr. McRuer says, no one might be found guilty except on the evidence of two witnesses. A false witness was himself liable to the same prescribed for the offence for which the accused was charged. So he would get what he expected the one being prosecuted would get if he was a false witness. And then just in Deuteronomy 19, over a page, verses 18 to 19, it says, and the judges shall make careful inquiry, and indeed, if the witness is a false witness who has testified falsely against his brother, then you shall do to him as he thought to have done to his brother, so you shall put away the evil from among you. If one witness contradicted another during the inquiry, either on examination or self-examination, the evidence of both became invalid. False witnesses were there, but their evidence was of no account. And some stood up and bore false witness against him, saying, we heard him say, I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another not made with hands. We just read that in Mark 14, verse 58. These witnesses, like most false witnesses, did not agree. And since they failed to agree, their evidence, according to Jewish law, was as if it had not been given. Jesus' accusers were surely hard put for an accusation that might support a capital offence when they entertained such evidence. Let's look at Mark 14, verses 60 to 64, and we'll see here on what charge he was finally condemned for. Mark 14, verse 60. It says, and the high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, saying, do you answer nothing? What is that these men testify against you? But he kept silent and answered nothing. Again the high priest asked him, saying to him, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? Jesus said, I am. And you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming with the clouds of heaven. Then the high priest tore his clothes and said, what further need do we have of witnesses? You have heard the blasphemy. What do you think? And they all condemned him to be deserving of death. Eventually, they found something to hang their hat on. The false witnesses had failed, but now it was blasphemy. If you'll turn back to Leviticus 21 verse 10, we will see who was guilty of doing wrong. It obviously wasn't Jesus here, but Leviticus 21 verse 10 will read who was the guilty party. Jesus was innocent of all charges, but we find someone who was indeed guilty of a crime, where it says, Leviticus 21 verse 10, he who is the high priest among his brethren, on whose head the anointing oil was poured, and who is consecrated to wear the garments, shall not uncover his head, nor tear his clothes. And what did we read in Mark 14 verse 63? It says, then the high priest tore his clothes. Who broke the law? The high priest did. It wasn't Jesus. He tore his clothes in self-righteous indignation when Christ plainly identified himself as the Son of God. Illegality number 8. According to Jewish law, a person could not be condemned by their own testimony. A person could not be condemned by their own testimony. If you'll turn to Luke 22, starting in verse 66, this is after Jesus had been mocked and beaten and they were still interrogating him. Luke 22, verse 66. It says, Luke 22, verse 66, As soon as it was day, the elders of the people, both chief priests and scribes, came together and led him into their council, saying, If you are the Christ, tell us. But he said to them, If I tell you, you will by no means believe. And if I also ask you, you will by no means answer me or let me go. Hereafter the Son of Man will sit on the right hand of the power of God. Then they all said, Are you then the Son of God? So he said to them, You rightly say that I am. And they said, What further testimony do we need? We have heard it ourselves from his own mouth. However, according again to Jewish law, a person could not be condemned by their own testimony. They all knew this, but they were so intent on making sure that Christ was going to be killed that they would just go to any lengths. Mr. McRuer again explains, he says, At this stage, Caiaphas forsook his role as the judge, and violating all the rules of Hebraic procedure, he undertook to accomplish what his minions had failed to do, to get Jesus to make a self-convicting statement. Until the case was established by the evidence of two or three witnesses given publicly, one standing trial for crime was not only presumed to be innocent, but to be unaccused. It was the evidence of the leading witnesses that constituted the charge. When they spoke and agreed, their evidence constituted the indictment. There being no evidence and hence no charge, Caiaphas stood up and heaped illegality upon illegality by calling upon Jesus to testify against himself. I'm not going to turn there because we read it a few minutes ago, but in Mark 14, verses 61 to 64, we read this a couple of minutes ago, but this passage shows the involvement of the high priest. Moses Maimonides 4.2 states, We have it as a fundamental principle of our jurisprudence that no one can bring an accusation against himself. Should a man make confession of guilt being before a legally constituted tribunal, such confession is not to be used against him unless properly attested by two other witnesses. Mendelssohn, in his book, The Criminal Jurisprudence of the Ancient Hebrews, writes, Not only is self-condemnation never extorted from the defendant by means of torture, but no attempt is ever made to lead him onto self-incrimination. Moreover, a voluntary confession on his part is not admitted in evidence, and therefore not competent to convict him, unless a legal number of witnesses minutely corroborate his self-accusation. The Jewish contemporary scholar Marimonius wrote in his book, We have it as a fundamental principle of our jurisprudence that no one can bring an accusation against himself. So this is at least three of their experts that are now saying that anything that you say cannot be used against yourself. Should a man make a confession of guilt before a legally constituted tribunal, such confession is not to be used against him unless properly attested by two other witnesses. And so it's clear that a defendant could not be condemned on their own testimony. Number 9. The merits of Jesus' defense were not considered. The merits of Jesus' defense were not considered. If you'll turn to Deuteronomy 13, verse 14 to 15. Deuteronomy 13, verses 14 to 15. Now, I know I'm giving you a lot of headings today and a lot of scriptures, but as I say, I'm happy to send the notes to you that you can look at afterwards as well. Deuteronomy 13, verse 14 to 15. This is another area that they did not follow through on. It was important that this was diligently executed, which it was not. It says, Then you shall inquire, search out, and ask diligently, And if it is indeed true and certain that such an abomination was committed among you, you shall surely strike the inhabitants of that city with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying it, all that is in it, and its livestock with the edge of the sword. The high priest did not inquire, search out, and ask diligently to see whether Jesus' statement was blasphemous. The law in the Mishnah states, the judges shall weigh the matter in the sincerity of their conscience. Instead, the court pronounced sentence instantly and unanimously. If you'll turn to Matthew 26, verses 59 to 60, where we read that this was not done. In fact, it was flagrantly ignored because it didn't suit their purpose. Matthew 26, verse 59. Matthew 26, verse 59 says, now the chief priests, the elders, and all the council sought false testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but found none. Even though many false witnesses came forward, they found none. But at least two false witnesses came forward. Again, another breach of the requirements by those in authority to inquire, to seek out, to search out, and to diligently ask. It was simply not done. They wanted to kill Jesus, and nothing was going to get in their way. Illegality number 10. Those who would have voted against condemnation were not at Jesus' trial. Now, in a sense, this could be seen as an extension of illegality number 4, but I think it's just slightly different. Those who would have voted against condemnation were not at Jesus' trial. If you'll turn to Luke 23, verses 50 and 51, we see the name of one council member. Now, this name is familiar to us because of events after the crucifixion. Luke 23, verse 50. It says, now behold, there was a man named Joseph, a council member, a good and a just man. He had not consented to their decision and deed. He was from Arimathea, a city of the Jews, who himself was also waiting for the kingdom of God. Joseph of Arimathea was a member of the court, yet he was not there, otherwise he would have opposed the events that transpired. He wasn't one of the that we mentioned earlier, one of the disciples that fled. He just wasn't there. Jesus' opponents had made sure that only those who hated him would be there. And in Matthew 27, verses 1 to 4, if you'll turn back there, here was a very remorseful disciple of Jesus who had realized his wrongdoing and wanted to turn the clock back. He wanted to give evidence, as we shall read, in defense of Jesus. Matthew 27, verse 1. When morning came, all the chief priests and elders of the people plotted against Jesus to put him to death. And when they had bound him, they led him away and delivered him to Pontius Pilate, the governor. Then Jesus, his betrayer, seeing that he had been condemned, was remorseful and brought back the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and elders, saying, I have sinned by betraying innocent blood. And they said, what is that to us? You see to it. Mr. McRuer writes, by now they were in no mood to hear any confessions that would tend to show the innocence of the prisoner on trial before Pilate. He, Judas, would probably know the requirements of the Jewish law in capital cases that the court must hear any witness in favor of an acquittal even after judgment was rendered, as long as the sentence had not been carried out. With his legal right to be heard by the court denied, Jesus threw down the tainted silver and went to his own destruction. The Sanhedrinists were again seized with a fit, I love this phrase, of scrupulosity. They would, for their own ends, disregard the law in the matter of life and death, but they were meticulous to observe it in a matter that was in comparison trivial. Please turn to Matthew 23, verse 23. And here we read of a withering attack on the scribes and Pharisees by Jesus. This was almost prophetic of the way that they would treat him a little later on. Matthew 23, verse 23 says, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin, and yet have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice, mercy and faith. These you ought to have done without leaving the others undone." As I read just a minute ago, they would, for their own ends, disregard the law in a matter of life and death, but they were meticulous to observe it in a matter that was by comparison very trivial. And so those who would have voted against condemnation against Jesus were not at his trial. Illegality number 11. The sentence was pronounced in a place forbidden by law. The sentence was pronounced in a place forbidden by law. Let us look at Luke 22, verse 54. This was after Jesus' betrayal and arrest in the Garden of Gethsemane. Luke 22, verse 54, it says, "Having arrested him, they led him and brought him into the high priest's house, but Peter followed at a distance." Mr. Link makes these following comments in his booklet. He says, "As we will recall, the trial took place in the house of the high priest, Caiaphas. This was another violation because it should have taken place at the regular meeting hall of the Sanhedrin. But it could not, as the court could not officially convene during the night. The law states in the Talmud, Idolatry, chapter 1, volume 8, after leaving the hall Gazith, the hall of hewn stones, no sentence of death can be passed upon anyone soever. And Maimonides in Sanhedrin 14 writes, a sentence of death can be pronounced only so long as the Sanhedrin holds its sessions in the appointed place. In the trial of capital cases, the great Sanhedrin was required to meet in an appointed place in the National Temple of Jerusalem, known as the Hall of Hewn Stones. Outside of this hall, no capital trial could be conducted and no capital sentence could be pronounced. So the sentence of death on Jesus was pronounced in a place that was forbidden by law. Illegal. Illegality number 12. Most of the judges were not legally qualified to try Jesus because most were his enemies. The members of the great Sanhedrin were legally disqualified to try Jesus. Mendelssohn, in his book on page 108, writes the following: "Nor must there be on the judicial bench either a relation or a particular friend or an enemy of either the accused or of the accuser." Benny, in his Criminal Code of Jesus, writes on page 37 the following: "Nor under any circumstances was a man known to be at enmity with the accused person permitted to occupy a position among the Jews." The members of the Sanhedrin were prejudiced against Jesus, and they sat at trial with vindictiveness in their hearts because Jesus interfered with the money-making schemes of the Jewish syndicate in the temple as recorded in the Gospels. In such cases, Jewish law required these judges to disqualify themselves in order to ensure that the accused would be tried by impartial judges. This they simply didn't do. Illegality number 13. the court illegally switched the charges from blasphemy to treason when the case went before Pilate. The court illegally switched the charges from blasphemy to treason when the court went to Pilate, when the case went to Pilate. Let's look at Luke 23, verses 1 and 2. Jesus' opponents wanted him killed, but they didn't want to do it themselves. Therefore, they charged him with treason. Luke 23, verse 1. Then the whole multitude of them arose and led him to Pilate, and they began to accuse him, saying, "We found this fellow perverting the nation and forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ, a king." Treason was a crime against Rome, so the Romans would be responsible for his death. No evidence of treason was ever presented. And if you'll turn to over a few pages to John 18, verses 29 and 30, we read what happened in Pilate's court. John 18, verse 29. John 18, verse 29 says, "Pilate then went out to them and said, 'What accusation do you bring against this man?' They answered and said to him, 'If he were not an evildoer, we would not have delivered him to you.'" Doesn't sound much of an answer to me, that doesn't. And over a page in John 19, verse 4, we read that it didn't take too long for Pilate to come to a decision. John 19, verse 4 says, "Pilate then went out again and said to them, 'Behold, I am bringing him out to you, that you may know that I find no fault in him.'" If Pilate found no fault in him, he made the determination that Jesus was not guilty of treason. Illegality number 14. No proper vote was taken. No proper vote was taken. We've already read in the passage of Mark 14, so no need to turn there, where we read, or we did read, about the high priest railroading the whole of the Sanhedrin, but I will quote verse 64 again, where he said, "You have heard the blasphemy. What do you think?" So he was saying, you know, come on, vote with me. And they all condemned him to be deserving of death. So they followed the lead of the high priest. Mr. McRuer writes the following. He said, "No vote of the members of the court was taken before Caiaphas announced the verdict." So the verdict was announced. He tore his robes and said, "He has uttered blasphemy. Why do we still need witnesses? You have heard his blasphemy. What is your judgment?" Caiaphas had himself given the judgment and performed the sacred rite. It would have been a courageous junior member of the Sanhedrin who, in the presence of Caiaphas and old Annas and all his sons, would have stood out for acquittal after that judgment was given. Indeed, it would have taken a very courageous person indeed to have taken that course of action. And so they all just seemed to acquiesce without a proper vote having been taken. But this is something that I had never heard of before, and maybe you hadn't. Had they taken a proper vote correctly, with everyone making up his own mind without being bullied into following the high priest, a fascinating detail of Jewish law would have come into play. No accused man could be convicted on an unanimous vote. A unanimous vote to convict automatically cleared the defendant. This strange quirk of Jewish law was a safeguard against railroading a defendant. Jesus was condemned on an unanimous vote, achieved by railroading or bulldozing at the behest of the high priest, and thus was not a proper vote. But as it was unanimous, he should have been cleared anyway. Whichever way you look at it, he should have been cleared, and the high priest and the Sanhedrin were yet again in gross error. And then finally on to illegality number 15. And again, I hadn't realized this. No death penalty could be passed if the defendant had been previously scourged. No death penalty could be passed if the defendant had been previously scourged. In Alfred Edersheim's book, The Life and Times of Jesus the Messiah, he writes, "But the sentence of death they could not pass," talking about the Sanhedrin. "Judgment was given and justice was doubly degraded. The Jewish law provided that no prolonged death might be inflicted on anyone, nor could any person condemned to death be previously scourged." And of course, Jesus had been previously scourged. On page 76 of Mr. McRuer's book, he writes the following about those in the Sanhedrin. He says, "They would, for their own ends, disregard the law in the matter of life and death, but they were meticulous to observe it in a matter that was in comparison quite trivial," which I've quoted before, but is worth repeating. In other words, they were legally speaking of that variety who pick and mix. He goes on to say, "The whole catalogue of illegality was complete. Jesus Christ, the prisoner, had been betrayed to his enemies for 30 pieces of silver, beaten and tortured by his custodians, illegally tried in the highest court in his nation, illegally convicted of blasphemy against the God of his people, a conviction never confirmed in the Roman court. Confirmation failing, the prisoner was charged with treason against the Roman emperor and found not guilty. Nevertheless, he was handed over to be crucified. In all the annals of legal history, it will be difficult to find another case in which a prisoner had been declared not guilty by a court of competent jurisdiction, was delivered to the executioner by the judge who had acquitted him." So Pilate said, he's not guilty, but here he is. As one observer on the internet wrote, "The trial of Jesus Christ stands as history's most stunning legal catastrophe. Those who were commissioned to uphold and preserve the law became its most violent and blatant violators." Walter M. Chandler, a Christian and a New York attorney, wrote an exhaustive two-volume work, The Trial of Jesus from a Lawyer's Standpoint, first published in 1908. It continues to be a significant resource, having been reprinted several times over the years. With the typical methodical precision of the lawyer's mind, and we know Mr. Link and his mind, the way that he is very precise, Chandler assembled a stunning indictment against the Jewish Supreme Court. Now, as an aside, you may be very interested in this information. I have no idea whether this is true, but I'm quoting it because it is, as an aside, very interesting. In a sermon by Wesley A. Swift, April the 15th, 1962, reopening the trial of Jesus Christ, he wrote the following. "In my library, I have the report of Pontius Pilate to Tiberius Caesar concerning what happened after his crucifixion. I have the report of his defense when Pilate was called to stand before Julius Caesar and give an account of the things that had happened under his administration and during the time of Christ, his crucifixion and his resurrection. I just want to add this. Pontius Pilate became," and I'm quoting this man, what he says he's got in his library, he says, "I want to add this. Pontius Pilate became a converted and complete accepting follower of Jesus. He was one of the most ardent, staunch admirers of Christ, and after the resurrection became identified with the early companies of Christians. He stood before Caesar after his wife had borne her testimony some years later and told him what had happened. And Caesar asked of Pilate, 'Has thy wife become a Christian, and art thou also a Christian?' And Pilate replied, 'Yes, I will take my lot with his, and I will stand with Jesus who rose from the dead.' Now, I never heard that proposal before, but it is interesting to say the least. And the author states that he has a report to this effect in his library. But that's just as an aside, an interesting aside. Today I've come up with 15 reasons why the trial of Jesus was illegal, whereas most people that I've read on the internet come up with 12 as we did originally. But without going through every list, a time-consuming task, they may have put a couple of items under one heading where I may have just split it, and it's not a big deal anyway. Because if there was only one item that was illegal, that was sufficient to make sure that Christ was not crucified. In the past, many sermons have been given with 7 points using biblical numerology, meaning complete. 12 is a perfect number signifying perfection of government or of governmental perfection. The number 12 normally deals with placing things within perfect order or achieving governmental structural perfection. And perhaps this is a reason why the number 12 figures so often. But just one illegality, as I said, should have been sufficient reason for the proceedings that went on nearly 2,000 years ago to have been made completely null and void. Understanding the political implications of the situation, Pilate allowed the Jews to crucify an innocent man. Of course, we understand the necessity of Jesus' death as an innocent victim. Now, as an aside, you probably don't get, or you may get in the United States, I don't know, but we get so much legislation in Europe and in the UK that is thrown at us in the UK from the European Union. We have foreign terrorists who hate our country, take from us our benefits and look from our welfare system. They thumb their nose at our law and get protected under the Human Rights Act, where we aren't allowed to deport them. So they can keep bleeding the system, but we can't send them back to where they came from. In 2011, the Home Secretary cited the example of a Bolivian immigrant who could not be deported because, and she said, I am not making this up, we couldn't deport him because he had a pet cat. In July 2012, it was reported that a deported Albanian robber who sneaked back into Britain to commit more crimes could stay to protect his human rights. In October 2012, a certain person fathered 4 children after fleeing to the UK from Honduras, where he was accused of killing the nephew of the country's former president. He has avoided deportation from Britain by claiming it would breach his right to a family life. So guess what? We've still got him. Human rights and more human rights. What human rights do you think Jesus Christ had when he was illegally charged and then murdered? Well, he had none at all. The trial of Jesus was a mockery of justice. However, this illegal trial did fulfill the prophecies concerning the condemnation of the Messiah as prophesied. And so it had to happen. And when it did happen, the worst traits of man were shown in order that he gets his own way, even if it meant trampling all over and ignoring so many legalities. If you'll turn to Matthew 27, verses 33 to 34. By this time Jesus had been crucified, the soldiers had mocked Jesus, and he would be in very serious pain. Matthew 27, verse 33. He said, and when they had come to a place called Golgotha, that is to say, place of a skull, they gave him sour wine mingled with gall to drink. But when he had tasted it, he would not drink. In his book, Crucified Jesus, Experience on the Cross, by Rick Renner, he writes the following. He said, there was a group of kind women in Jerusalem who made it their good deed to help anesthetize the pain of people who were dying horrific deaths. These women wanted to eliminate as much pain and misery as possible for the scores of people being crucified by the Romans. Therefore, they produced the homemade painkiller, and Matthew tells us about this verse. The kind women of Jerusalem wanted to anesthetize Jesus to remove his pain, but he refused their painkiller and entered into the experience of the cross with all his faculties. Let us not allow the world to anesthetize us, causing us to overlook, to forget, or to esteem lightly the enormous price our Saviour paid for each one of us on the stake of Calvary.